if we're going to increase the rate of rollout even quicker, we need to fix these small things in the way that projects are delivered in Britain at the moment. It isn't a lack of engineering resource. It will be one of two things. It will either be because someone somewhere has to sign a piece of paper, or because there is a connection, electrical connection that needs to be made, and it's waiting to get in the road and make those works happen. And it is a good news story because we've got the solutions there. We're working with the DNOs to make it quicker. And unlike, how do we solve 2050 in terms of all the offshore wind we need and the transmission network? This is human beings stamping pieces of paper. This is stuff we can fix right now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back for another installment of Transmission. In today's episode, guest host Ed Porter is speaking to Osprey Charging CEO Ian Johnston. The conversation covers everything from common EV misconceptions to what the business model for charging providers might look like in the future. If you're enjoying Transmission, please hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And with that, let's jump in.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Transmission. Today I'm joined by Ian Johnston, CEO of Osprey. Ian, welcome.
Great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. So today I'm really excited about today because I've got a really good series of questions, but also you know your onions in the EV space, and I'm super excited to kind of run through them and just actually dig into a couple of these topics in a little more detail. But to start off with, I actually want to do something a little bit more like myth busting. And good. So I think you will know the answer to all of these. Mm-hmm. Let's kick off with EV sales.
Yeah.
Are they going up? Are they going down?
Well, the data tells the story that last year, 2023, the EV sales were up 18% year on year on 2022. So, there is huge growth in the sector, both globally, in the UK market. There are a lot of grey clouds with even more myths that need to be busted. And there are some challenges without a doubt. But no, the growth and the volume of the market is there for everyone to see. There's now 1 million plug-in vehicles on the road, which is a great milestone. I think we're approaching 3% though, adoption, only 3%. So there's so much more to go, but no, the pace of adoption is increasing all the time.
Okay, so I think that myth firmly busted. Next myth, there are not enough chargers.
Okay, so this one, I think the honest answer to this is that if you take two moments in time, if you look at maybe 2.5 years ago, versus where we are right now today, we're in a different universe in terms of where is the charging infrastructure in the UK. So last year, we crossed over there being 50,000 public charge points in the UK. And of course, that number needs some context around it. But that's a 45% increase on where we started the year. And we're in the position now where of all the charge points out there in the UK, one in three of them were installed last year. So what we're seeing is that there's significantly more infrastructure than there was this time last year, and the rate of rollout is increasing all the time, down to a number of reasons. So the projects which are being built are larger. There are a far larger number of operators building these projects. There's government funding coming through, and there's work being done by industry to make it quicker to deploy these projects. So I think there were people who quite fairly were saying, there's not enough infrastructure 2 years ago. The headlines have continued, but the story on the ground is very different today, and it's getting better. So by the end of this year, we're gonna look back at 2023 and say, well, that was quite a quiet year, because that ramp up is just incredible at the moment.
And actually, just to dig into that a little bit, right? So a 45% increase year on year for something that is kind of physical infrastructure being built.
Yeah.
That's actually quite difficult to kind of comprehend. Well, like what's been the big release that's let you be able to kind of deploy an extra 45%?
Look, it's still a fairly new sector. If you look at it from an Osprey perspective, at the start of last year, we had 400 chargers in the UK, and that had taken us 5 years to build up the experience, the expertise of how to do this, but also the credibility in securing the leases and the landlords to do it with. So you can only build, of course, where you can secure the rights, the grid and all those things. So we had 400 after 5 years of work. Last year, we did it in 12 months. We did it in 9 months, actually. So there's an expertise, there's a professionalism, there's a scale, the investment. And again, every site that we build is now much larger. So we're giving drivers more availability of chargers, which means whereas when we used to launch a site, it might have two chargers in, now it might have 16 or 32. So there's a number of factors that are causing that ramp up, but it's just causing an explosion of EV charging rollout right across the UK and all the different forms of site location you might see.
And one thing you said there was we have a million EVs on the road and 50,000 public charge points, right?
Correct.
Is that the right ratio in terms of like 20 to 1?
Really good question. So government and a few bodies use this figure of, well, we need 30,000 or 300,000 charge points in the UK. There is no one number or no one ratio which we should look at. And the reason is that around 65 to 75% of vehicle drivers in the UK have a private driveway. So for those people, they will, what we used to say in the industry is they will charge their car in the same way you and I charge our mobile phone. So you wake up in the morning and the car will be full. That was a phrase we used to try and make clear, A, how simple it is to live with an EV, but also how the people that will be using the public charging networks are those who don't have a private driveway at home or who are doing high mileage on the roads. So if you're if the average EV does, say, 250 miles, I mean, how often does the average person in the UK with a car do more than 250 miles in a day where they need to charge on the road? But what we realize is by telling people that you can charge your car like your phone, it makes them think, I need to plug my car in every night. That seems a hassle or it's going to cost a lot of money. In reality, for most people with an EV, they probably charge their car at home once every 2 weeks. And therefore, the people using the public charging networks are the, and it's a huge group of people, but it's the fleet drivers, it's those doing long journeys, and of course, the huge commercial market as well. So there's no one simple answer of how many public chargers should there be. It's certainly not one for every vehicle. But again, it will depend on the user case. Are you a fleet driver, a private driver? Is it that once a year you drive to Cornwall, or is it every week because you're doing 1,000 miles a week on the motorway? So there's no simple answer, but I think the point is that if you look at the ratio between new EV sales and new public chargers going in, this time last year, in January 23, a lot of headlines saying, look, the ratio is getting worse, there's more EVs, the chargers can't keep up. At the end of 2023, the ratio being balanced, and you are now seeing a like-for-like rise both in chargers and EV sales because that deployment rate has increased so quickly.
Okay, so starting to keep hold of that ratio.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. And one thing you mentioned there, and you explained this to me before we started recording, around fleet, because I think people will kind of fall into the same trap that I fell into, thinking that means like a commercial fleet in terms of, say, the Royal Mail's vans. What does a fleet mean to someone who's kind of up to speed in the space?
Yeah, I think so. For most people, if you think about private drivers, the mileage that we do is very low. You know, the car sits on the driveway for most of the week, and if you do commute to work or to the station, you're probably doing 5-10 miles a day. The fleet usage, when we refer to it in that way, is commercial mileage. So, of course, you have vehicles that are ran by companies for company work. But the fleet sector also includes people who have a vehicle through their employer as a benefit.
Right.
So it's registered by the company as a company car or as a salary sacrifice through that company. But fleet also includes all the leasing companies. So again, if anybody buys a car on finance, on PCP or hire purchase, that again can be included in a fleet registration. So again, many different user cases within there, but there are huge different sectors of the market. And where you've seen, I think it's around 90% of EV registrations last year were in that fleet sector, either because there are large benefits there if you take an EV as a company car. Yeah. There are some really attractive salary sacrifice schemes out there where you can pay through your payroll. But again, many people in the UK buy their car on monthly payments, not outright with cash. And that again will go through a leasing company and be a fleet deal. So again, you may do 1 mile a week, you may do 1,000 miles a week, but you might sit within that fleet bracket as well.
Okay, I think that's cleared it up. Last myth, EV charging points are always busy or they're broken.
Yeah, so I think, again, when we go back to the state of the charging infrastructure 2 years ago, probably half of what was in the ground out there was what we would call legacy infrastructure. So there were some companies that went out there many, many years before us and tried to change the world and change, you know, the state of UK road transport and built this infrastructure. It was early technology. The commercial arrangements were you know, ahead of their time, but probably not fit for purpose for today. So there was a chance that if you picked a random EV charger, it may be one of those legacy bits of infrastructure. As I said earlier, one in three of all the charge points out there now are less than 12 months old. They're being installed by reputable, reliable, professional nationwide networks, and we can't afford for a new driver to turn up to our sites and for it to not work. So we're in a different universe today. What's helpful is that the government have launched the Consumer Regulations Act now. So we will now be mandated to achieve and maintain 99% uptime for drivers, and there'll be penalties and reports based upon that. The charging industry embraces that and supports it fully, because we know we have to say to drivers that there is a reliable network out there for you as and when you need it. So from an Osprey perspective, we of course work really hard on it. We want the drivers to know they can rely on the network. We achieved 99% last year already. So no, I think there will always be horror stories on Panorama and on the Daily Mail of people who want to try and raise these issues. But not only is the infrastructure reliable, but as I said earlier, the sites we're building now are 1632 chargers. So there will always be an available charger for you, because we're building the infrastructure ahead of demand. Remember, there's not even 3% of cars on the road at EVs yet, but we're building hubs that are ready for 2035 today.
I wonder if this story will kind of always stick around, right? Because you will sit with a commercial hat on and try and build an EV charging station where you have, say, 20 or 40 EV charging points, and that will cater for 99% of the times. But on the one sort of hot bank holiday that comes around, all of a sudden everyone wants to drive from somewhere in, let's say, the Midlands or London down to, say, Cornwall, and all of a sudden you'll have this one sort of pinch point, let's call it Fleet. Lovely service station, by the way, not meaning to sort of cause any disrespect to Fleet services, but you might go to Fleet and all of a sudden you see like this massive queue of EVs, and there's kind of no way that you would ever be able to build enough infrastructure to be able to deal with that. And then you'll always get someone on their phone takes a picture and goes, oh, look at this, EV chargers, they can't handle it.
On Christmas Day last year, there were headlines on the news and on New Year's Day about the queues at the services. This year, there were no horror stories on the news at all, despite there being, you know, an uplift in the EV sales. I think the one thing that's interesting about charging an EV is that electricity is all around us, which means you can charge your vehicle anywhere. So whilst there will be, you know, huge provision of charging at the motorway services, but for many people doing that journey on that hot summer's day, many of them will have charged their car at home before, and many of them can charge at many other points on the road where you couldn't previously refuel your vehicle. So it might be at a supermarket, it might be at a retail park, it might be at the coffee shop you want to stop at, but EV charging can be anywhere where there's electricity. And therefore it means that the pinch points are going to have less pressure than the fuel forecourts have done historically.
Yeah.
So the key here is to put EV charging in the places where you want to spend your time anyway. And actually, when we've achieved that, it means that you don't need to go out of your way to refuel. Your car can refuel when you've stopped anyway. So I think, look, again, 2 years ago, there were queues. There were queues in the places where people were going. And now that you can choose to charge your car in many, many locations, be it a motorway service station, a coffee shop, a supermarket, a retail park, town centre car park, it's going to be everywhere.
Yeah. Let's put a pin in the in that particular part about if you have a petrol station right now, what do you do in the future? Because I definitely want to come back to that. I think there are some interesting tipping points and dynamics around how that changes. Let's just cover a bit of the groundwork. So can any EV work with any EV charger? How does that work?
So there are primarily on public rapid charging now, there are two connectors, and the decision has really been made by industry in Europe to go with what they call a CCS connector. There's another connector called the Chidimo or Chadimo, which I believe in Chinese means T-break.
Okay.
It is when you stop to use that one. That was very popular a few years ago with the Nissan Leaf and other models from the Far East. But what you're seeing today is all models coming into the market now are using the CCS connector. Okay. But most charge points now do still offer both cables. The answer to your question, to be really clear, is that the market has made the decision in terms of, you know, the Betamax versus VHS. CCS is the answer for Europe, and every public charger can connect to those vehicles. Now, the reason there's a question on this is that what's happened in the US is that many of the US public charger networks have adopted the Tesla connector. So people are saying, well, surely then is that going to happen in Europe? Well, all the European chargers have to change to a Tesla connector. Am I going to have to change my connector? No, because in Europe, Tesla is also using CCS. So for all of the listeners in Europe, CCS is the answer, and you can use every charge point with a CCS connector, which is great news. And in the US, there's a common answer again, which is the Tesla standard.
Okay.
So if we were sat here 4 years ago, there'd be an interesting debate over, is it CHAdeMO or CCS? But that decision's been made, and you can see with the vehicles coming out now that is the case.
Yeah. Okay. So, this feels a little bit like the Apple Lightning charging cable moving to USB-C, European standard. We all need to kind of get to the same standard so we have the same charging cables.
Yeah. Thankfully, a lot less painful than that, because there wasn't, we weren't already at a stage of mass adoption like we all were with our Apple cables, where we're having to change now. So it's a lot simpler than that, thankfully.
Okay. Only bone to pick, CCS. It really is. That's another CCS in the energy space. As long as you don't rebrand to CCUS, we should have no problem.
Yeah. I think, ideally, now that there's only one choice, we shouldn't need to use the phrase CCS. It should just be a connector.
Just the connector.
So hopefully that's another acronym we can forget about and not need to describe to people.
Okay. And then kind of going from your Osprey world to home chargers, like how are home chargers different to the CCS chargers that you see?
So the key difference between the different types of charger is the amount of time it takes to charge the vehicle, and therefore the amount of power that's passing through them. So typically in a home charging environment or an on-street, like a lamppost charging environment, you're looking to charge that vehicle overnight, and that's where you're going to have a charge with a power somewhere between 3 kilowatts and maybe 7 kilowatts. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's going to take between, let's say, 8 to 12 hours to charge that vehicle.
Okay.
With a public rapid charge point, what you're really looking to do is to match the charge rate, the power, and the time to the length of time that you naturally want to spend there.
Okay.
So if it is a fuel forecourt where you traditionally will refuel your car, you'll go in, you might use the loo, buy a coffee, that's probably a 15 to 20 minute stay. So in those en route pit stop locations, you're looking for a high power charger to deliver that charge that you want in around 15 to 20 minutes. If you are going to the supermarket and the weekly shop takes you 45 minutes, you need a less powerful charger so that when you leave the supermarket, your car has reached the desired charge level. And again, if you're going to the cinema, you need a lower power charger again for a 3 hour charge. Now, what we don't have yet established is the right terminology across these different types of chargers. And there's some work going on right now with the UK government and with the industry around really defining these phrases. So you'll hear people talk about fast charging, which in Europe means the very rapid charging, but in the UK it means the long stay charging. Really confusing, really unhelpful. So what will be coming out later this year is some clarification on the terminology that everybody will use, from the car companies on the TV adverts through to the charging companies and all the mapping tools as well. But the key difference from home to supermarkets to the en route pit stop sites is the rate of charge you're taking.
Mm-hmm.
So a rapid charger starts at 50 kilowatts. That might give you a charge in between 45 minutes to an hour. Again, the ultra rapid chargers are giving you a charge in 15 minutes. But this opens another can of worms, really, which is probably worth touching on, which is, of course, we can only provide as much power and as much electricity as the car can take. And I used to work in marketing for Volkswagen and Audi, and we used to spend millions of pounds trying to make you want the vehicle. And of course, what they're going to do is they're going to say, you can charge this new £80,000 Audi in 9 minutes. So, of course, you will rock up to the charge point thinking, well, this is only going to take 9 minutes. But what's quite interesting is that the systems within the vehicle which protect the battery and control the battery and the temperature actually mean that the rate of charge changes through the state of the battery's charging profile. So the first 20% or the last 20%, the charging is slowed down to protect the battery. And again, you're getting into a level of detail here where the car dealers are not explaining this to drivers. So this is an area where there needs to be a load of education from industry, from government, to explain how does EV charging work. But the good news is there is a crude way to think about it, which is you really, when you're looking to charge in public, you're looking to charge your car from, say, 20% full to 80% full. It doesn't make sense to stay on the charger over 80% because it's going to take ages, because the car will slow the charge rate down to protect the battery. So we talk in the industry about charging your vehicle to 80% and then you get on your way. Huh. Our job is to make sure we're putting the right charger in. So what you don't want is an ultra rapid charger in a supermarket where you're going to be 45 minutes anyway buying your groceries. What you don't want is a slow charger in a fuel forecourt where you want to get out of there as quick as you can. And as I say, we've now got a nationwide network of, you know, professional networks who are doing it the right way. And it should be frictionless and you shouldn't ever need to think about the rate you're getting.
Okay, I think that was a bit of a. We actually touched on a load of really good topics in there. For people who kind of kilowatt as a foreign concept,
yeah.
I always like to think of a kettle as being like 3 kilowatts ish. So your lowest range would be like almost a kettle's worth type power.
Yeah.
And then you're talking about a 400 kilowatt charger that is essentially 100x that. So 100 kettles. Imagine that going into your car.
Yeah.
It's fascinating that we're starting to get to the level where we can start to see the kind of charge profiles of some of these of different types of car model. I wonder if some of that is also in terms of stationary storage, a lot of it's linked to temperature for obvious reasons. Is that kind of a big driver in terms of if you're charging on a cold day, you might be able to charge more quickly than if you're charging on a hot day? Okay.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I think, and also the vehicle range is affected by the temperature as well. So I drive an Audi e-tron in the summer. When you get into the car, it probably says about 220 miles. In the winter, that might be as low as 180. Now, I should say to the audience that, you know, that's a very early EV, and, you know, most EVs today are doing, you know, far, far in excess of that. But the temperature does affect it. What's interesting, if you read what comes from the automotive sector, there will always be a race for the furthest range, the most powerful charge rate. I think where the real developments will be from a technological perspective is the cooling of the batteries and the efficiency of that charge rate. So yeah, battery temperature is a key focus for investment for the car companies. Yeah. And of course, our job is to make sure that we have the infrastructure that is matching the batteries in the vehicle. There's a lot of what they call 800 volt technology coming in now in the Porsche Taycans and in some of the Hyundai models, which means you can charge quicker. Mm. We're going to get to the point really where, you know, the car might be charged quicker than you've been in to use the loo and to grab your Mars bar. So it's all about matching the right charge rate to the right location.
Okay. And let's go back to the EV charging side. So let's go back to this the actual process of putting in, say, 40 or 50 charge points into, say, a lay-by, wherever it may be.
Yeah.
What are the challenges with doing that?
I think one of the things that people find surprising is the amount of power that we're talking about here. So when we first started out and we were putting in, you know, two 50 kilowatt charge points into a retail site, we would work with many en route fast food locations and coffee shops. And the power that we were securing for these two parking bays was the same as the entire fast food restaurant. Okay, so you're not plugging your chargers into the store. You're bringing an entire new power connection here. And if you look at the small hubs today, that's a similar size infrastructure as when I used to build wind farms before. And now we're building substations for these hubs, which are the same as housing estates. So there's a huge amount of power going in. We're building, you know, bespoke substations to build this infrastructure. So the challenges are now that once we've worked with the landlord and agreed the commercial terms upon which we will be their tenant, or we've bought the land, as Osprey are now doing, to build these sites, then of course the steps we have to go through are we need to work with the DNO for the grid connection, which is anything from, you know, 200 kVA or 200 kilowatts through to 2, 3, 4 megawatts, so very large connections. It was a lot easier to do that in renewables. When we were building wind farms and solar farms, to make those connections in rural areas, we were digging through farmers' fields. It was easy. There was nothing really in the way. Maybe the odd dead Roman in the ground that you'd have to stay away from. But now we're dealing through industrial areas. You're digging through A roads. You're digging under motorways. You're trying to go through the car park of, instead of, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones's garden, it's the Halfords car park and you know, three housing estates. So this is, you know, built up areas, it's big infrastructure. The civil works are very complex. So getting the permits in place to do that, the highways permits, the planning permits, takes a long, long time. And when governments say to us, what can we do to help you guys build quicker? This is where we're focused.
Okay.
And there's a key point I want to make, which is around the grid. So again, we've been building renewable infrastructure for, I think, 15 years now. The grid has always been a delay and everyone always blames the grid. But when we talk about the grid in EV charging world, we're not talking about it in the same way in most cases. So when you hear about the grid being a delay in the national press, they're talking about the delays of building offshore wind farms and new transmission network upgrades for what we need for 2050. But for us, when we talk about the grid, we're talking about the process we have to go through to build something in the UK right now. And it's just, how do we get that planning permit for something which everybody wants? No one here is objecting to EV charging. Everybody wants it. It's not like onshore wind farms in your back garden. Mm. We had lots of problems with the planning before. So, you know, we're waiting months for planning. We're waiting months to get the highways permits. And then the legal process to sign all the documents for the substations is taking months and months and months. The great news here is this is all stuff we can solve. Like now, we can solve it this year. So we're working together with the DNOs and with government to try and remove these barriers and to just give us the permitted rights to go and build. But it is complicated. It does take time. And it's interesting you raised Fleet Services earlier, because I think Fleet is one of those locations where there have been chargers installed and sat waiting for, I think, a very long time, many, many months or even years to be flicked on. So it is complicated. There's a huge amount of time, a massive amount of investment going in. Mm. And we're doing all of this years ahead of demand. As well. So I think that's why you see a number of the businesses that are excelling in this space, like Osprey, like the likes of GridServe and Instavolt and others. We all come from the renewable sector. We've been building solar farms and wind farms, battery projects for many, many years, because it's the same skill set required, planning, grid and permits like that.
And a couple of interesting things. So those, I have to ask, the Fleet, the charging points that were there but not flicked on, is that just an absence of like a qualified person to come and approve it, or is it DNO testing? What was the final thing that meant that actually the millions of pounds that have gone into making this thing happen were just sat there idle? That must be super frustrating.
Yeah, I can't talk for the company that who those chargers are for, but there are many, many projects across the UK sat waiting to be switched on. It isn't a lack of engineering resource. Mm. It will be one of two things. It will either be because someone somewhere has to sign a piece of paper, you know, for a permit for the substation or otherwise, or because there is a connection, electrical connection that needs to be made in a road somewhere, in an A road, or God forbid in the motorway, and it's waiting to get in the road and make those works happen. And of course, we're competing with the gas networks and everybody else. So this is the point around, look, if we're going to increase the rate of rollout even quicker, we need to fix these small things in the way that projects are delivered in Britain at the moment. And there are, and it is a good news story, because we've got the solutions there. We're working with the DNOs to make it quicker. And unlike, crikey, how do we solve, you know, 2050 in terms of all the offshore wind we need and the transmission network? This is human beings stamping pieces of paper. This is stuff we can fix right now.
And the other thing that's really nice about this, right, is that unlike a massive nuclear project, which is kind of very singular and kind of one of a kind type thing, the work that needs to be done here, it's an EV charger. There are lots of them. It's a transformer. It's a substation. It's cabling. These are all very modular things. And if the wind and solar industry has taught us anything, it's that actually ramping up modular things is actually relatively easy to do. Yeah. And you can get cost benefits from doing it. So is that something you're seeing in terms of the actual fundamental cost of the parts? Is that coming down or is it going up?
Oh, yeah. I think it's interesting. If you look at the cost of the solar components and what's happened there, I think we're going to see the same thing happening here with EV chargers. I mean, the you're right. The technology we need to do this is here. We've got the technologies here. The expertise is here now. And the funding is there. So all the pieces are there. And whilst I talk about the frustrations of the process we go through, let's remember the massive ramp up we saw last year. So we all want to go even quicker. We all think there should be even more infrastructure. But you're right, all the parts of the jigsaw already exist there today. We're going to see the cost come down. There will be developments in terms of the battery technology and the components inside that. But I think, unlike a wind farm, a solar farm, or a biomass plant, the difference here is there's a human being at the end of it. And what that means is where the real development will be in the UI. It will be in the interface of that human. And there's so much debate on, you know, do we really want the human have to do anything? If you look at what Tesla have delivered here, where you literally just plug the car in, it does it all for you. There's a huge debate out there on, well, who will own the wallet? Is it the car company? Is it the leasing company? Is it your home energy company? Loads of innovation to come. Probably less so on the electrical component piece, because it's already kind of proven and working today.
So that's a great lead in, actually, to what does this space look like in 5 years' time?
Well, I think for a start, in 5 years' time, there's going to be EV charging absolutely everywhere. I wonder whether the EV charging networks are going to look and feel more like mobile phone networks, in terms of, you know, if you approach a roundabout, and I've used this example a few times, but if you imagine you have an Osprey charging hub, a GridServe charging hub, a BP charging hub, an Instavolt charging hub, what can I do to make you turn right into my site. If all of the sites are reliable, if we're all offering you 16 bays to choose from, there's fantastic amenities with a great coffee shop and a toilet there and playground for your kids, what will it take then to make you turn right? And if you look at what the mobile phone company's done around, you know, historically Orange Wednesdays and, you know, priority tickets to events, where will the sector go then? I think that's one interesting dynamic. I think ease of use in the parking bay is essential. So right now, certain companies, I mean, Osprey, we spend a lot of time and money on trying to make the bays as accessible as we can and as easy to use as we can. That's going to be really important to make sure that the charging infrastructure is accessible to everybody, whether you have certain needs or whether you're just a van driver, you need more space. So we'll all be looking for different ways to compete with each other in that regard.
Oh, you said everything but price. So why, like price, if I look at petrol stations today, it's like people drive around and they look at the numbers that are 152. Okay, I noted that, right. Drive on to the next one, 148. Oh, okay, I might come back there later on. But surely price is going to be a major impact here.
Well, I think today, to be honest with you, whilst there's been this massive uplift in EV charging rollout, I mean, there is still so much more deployment that needs to happen until you're at the point where you do have those four, you know, charging hubs next to each other. I mean, we do, there's a site in Banbury today where we sit within, you know, meters of a Tesla site and a few minutes of an Instavolt site, and all the sites are busy, you know, because we're at that point of demand still. I think there probably aren't, you're not at a point yet today where every charging network is very reliable. Not every charging network today is very easy to use, and there aren't 8-16 chargers in every site. So today we don't see it. Clearly the cost of ownership and the cost of use is going to be key for the fleets, and all those fleet cards and those roaming companies, that those business models will grow and grow into the space. But when we talk to drivers today, of course, in this cost of living crisis, everybody would like to pay less, as we all would do for coffee, for train tickets, for everything. Yeah. But no, I think today it's really about the ease of experience, and it's about the reliability. Mm-hmm. And those networks that are getting that right, they are the ones that are winning at the moment.
Okay. Yeah.
Price is interesting, if I may, because I think we get asked about this a lot, but of course we've been through this energy crisis. Mm. So the average cost of a public rapid charger has gone from around 40p to about 80p. Mm-hmm. And the question that's being asked now is, but you know, the home energy price cap has come down, so why is public charging twice as expensive? And this is a really interesting thing, which was quite hard to explain in the middle of the crisis. And I when I saw Martin Lewis struggling to explain it on national TV, I felt that the industry was
in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. I thought I don't feel so bad that I can't explain this to our customers either. So there is no price cap for commercial energy use, of course. Mm. So we are paying the raw price in the market. And that, whilst it's come down from the peak of you know, September 2 years ago, it's still about 50 to 80% more than it was. Okay, so the cost of electricity is a lot more. But the other thing that's changed significantly because of something called the code review is that the standing charges we're all now paying are astronomically higher than they were before. Now, the reason is good. The reason is good is because that money is going into upgrading the transmission network and building more grid projects. We've had more EV charging projects being built because of that. So it's a good thing. But an unintended consequence is that where you have large connections, you're paying huge standing charges, astronomical, in some cases, 10 times more what they were 2 years ago.
Yeah. And for people outside of the UK,
standing
charges, unit rates, do you want to do a quick?
So you basically, when you secure a level of connection to the grid, you pay every day, almost like an availability fee for having that capacity. But of course, the conundrum with EV charging is let's say we build a 10 megawatt project that we know in 2035 will be full with, you know, 32 bays charging all day long. That's what everybody wants to see us build right now. And that's what we're building. And we're paying the standing charge, the monstrous standing charge, for that huge grid connection. But less than 3% of the cars on the road are EVs, and 80% of the EVs have a home charger. So the issue is that huge standing charge is being placed on the charging projects today. So again, there's good news here. I'm not here to bring horror stories. I'm here to bring great news, which is that government and Ofgem are aware of this, and we're working together to work out what can be done to make it more affordable. But the reality is, to build the infrastructure that people want is significantly more expensive than it was 2 years ago. And that's why there's a lot of debate right now on what could be done to bring down that cost of charging. Yeah. You'll see things in the press around what can we do with VAT and these things. And that's because we're trying to get that to make sure that EV charging is affordable for everybody. Okay. But there's it's a complex subject which I could talk for hours on.
Yeah, and let's just do it a little bit, right? So let's talk a little bit about the business model that goes into this. So yeah. If I put my sort of financier's hat on, the kind of key things are you're looking at number of vehicles coming through per year, you're thinking about the cost of procuring energy from the market, and then you're looking at essentially the price that it's going into the vehicles at. Those are broadly the three kind of key areas that one is kind of the key revenue, the other is key cost, and then there's the cost to build, the capex. Are there other parts of the revenue stack?
So I think there will be new revenue streams, ancillary streams that come in to the models over time, but the core base model here is that, of course, you are the critical pieces. You're finding locations, or you're able to secure locations where human beings want to spend their time in large numbers. Okay. And this is why it's in some ways quite different to fuel forecourts. So you're looking at where do people want to spend their time, where we can bring the power in to charge their vehicles whilst they're doing what they do, if it's a toilet stop or if it's a shopping break, etc. So then once you've secured those key locations, which give you the volume of people coming in, it's about, can we achieve a viable grid connection here? So in some cases, they'll say, yes, you can have your 2-3 megawatts here and it's going to cost you £500,000. Fantastic, that's great. In some cases where they might say, look, you need to upgrade the network here, it's going to cost you £10 million and take 3 years to bring in. And that's where you might look for government schemes to intervene when it's not commercially viable to do so. Mm-hmm. So you're right, it's a volume of people and a reasonable level of capex where over the life of the project, over the 15, 20, 25 years, you're covering that capex, you're covering refreshing the technology, because the chargers we put in today will not be the same chargers that you'll see in 10 years. Because again, I want you to choose my site because it's got the best interface, the best technology there for you. So I'll upgrade.
Like it'll expire. You're saying, and actually to get people to come in, I need to make sure that I've got the best kit.
So we at Osprey presume we will be upgrading this all the time to make it better for you. So of course we need to cover that capex, cover the refresh, break even, and then make the return over the long term. But let's be clear, we are investing millions of pounds, and the sector is investing in the UK billions of pounds to build this infrastructure today for 10, 15 years time.
Okay.
So it's certainly a long-term play. And I think that's one of the reasons why the model which has been so successful in the UK is where you see charging networks being a tenant and taking a lease from a retailer. Because the retail owners look at the model and say, you know, and in many cases they're working on, they need a 3-year payback for a capital investment program. That's never going to work for EV charging. So we spend lots of time talking to landlords and retailers who say, look, we're interested, we may do this ourselves. They look at the model and think, wow, crikey, we can't do this, but please guys, come and show us how it's done, and we'll take a rent or a profit share from you instead.
Yeah, and I feel like actually we put a pin in this earlier, which is, let's call it Tesco or Sainsbury's, right? A lot of those supermarkets which want you to come and stay for an hour, hour and a half, will have a petrol station because it's a natural draw. So why do I go to Tesco's or why do I go to Sainsbury's? Oh, there's a petrol station there, so I'll just pull in. That makes my life easier. At some point, as time goes on, you see that 3% become 10%, 20%, 30%. All of a sudden, petrol stations start to see a fewer number of cars coming through and less petrol being put into vehicles. In terms of the economics of keeping this petrol station open, you will start to see people go, actually, maybe this petrol station doesn't work and I might decide to sort of take it offline and get rid of that. There becomes a bit of a tipping point here, because if you then drive a petrol car, you're going, well, I used to be able to top up Tesco's, but now it's EV. And I used to be able to top up just over there in Fleet Services, but now there isn't a petrol station there for me. Do you kind of see this kind of last 30% of petrol stations going quite quickly? Because all of a sudden you have petrol vehicles where they're going, I used to be able to top up everywhere, in effect, just because there are petrol stations everywhere. But now there are, because the numbers are going down and there's this kind of tipping point that's been reached, I now have to drive 30 minutes the wrong way to get petrol, which is now super expensive, when actually I could just be charging up overnight and I don't have to drive anywhere. Do you see that?
I think if you look at the reasons as to why are petrol forecourts great locations for EV charging, and then why are they not great locations? So the many petrol forecourts are in fantastic strategic locations on major roundabouts. So there will be some great EV charging sites at some petrol forecourts, and we've built some in the Osprey network. But the practicalities of installing an electrical substation on top of a huge liquid fuel deposit are quite significant. So I think what we'll probably see is there'll be some there'll be some key strategic locations where you see some providers taking out the fuel pumps early to install EV charging hubs, where they have the space to distance the electrical away from the fuel. But in many locations, I think you'll probably see different locations being formed. And we're seeing this today with some of the forecourt operators who are just buying land and building new locations instead. So I think it's easier to build on greenfield, brownfield or retail land than it is on a fuel forecourt. Mm-hmm. But some of them are in fantastically good locations. Mm-hmm. So I think some of those will still be fuel forecourts in 20 years' time. And let's remember, the ZEV mandate, the zero emission vehicle mandate in the UK, requires that 80% of vehicles sold will be electric by 2035. There will still be millions of petrol and diesel cars on the road. There'll still be lots of vehicles out there buying liquid fuel. So there will still be a forecourt industry out there. My guess is that most of the charging sites will be on new locations.
Okay. So if you see the petrol forecourt and the EV charging very much being like a school disco, being either side of the car park, that's what's going on. They don't want to they don't mix very well.
I can't talk for their business models in those businesses, but I know technically it's not the simplest thing to do. Okay. I think there are some, I mean, I've been to Shell sites, BP sites, MFG sites where they have both co-located, but it's normally in their larger sites where you can put distance between the two. And of course, share the amenities between them.
And so the last question for me before I jump into your contrarian view and anything you'd like to plug is about, this is one for sort of the power nerds, I'm going to say. So the thing when we look at the future of the power markets, we see power demand going up. So we see heat pumps going in, we see EV charging going in, electrification of a lot of processes, which is all essential for reducing carbon emissions. And the shape of that, so how spiky that demand is, becomes really important for how you model that. And EV charging being one of those key points, the future of that could go two ways in my eyes. You've kind of got this theory that perhaps everyone will go past a 400 kilowatt charging point, and everyone will rapid charge between 7 and 9 in the morning and 4 and 6 when they drive home, and you'll see these two big spikes when people get in their cars and they want to charge immediately. Or there's the school of thought of the majority of people will probably have a sort of domestic 7 to 11 kilowatt charger. They'll plug it in overnight and there'll be flexible tariffs. And actually, demand won't get more spiky, but demand will be flat. What do you think?
I think the shape will change over time. Because again, you've got to remember today, the people that have EVs today predominantly have home charging as well. So we're probably not seeing the true play out of the game at the moment. What we see today is that more than a spike, we see a hump through the day, where it's busier at lunchtime and it tails off through the afternoon. I think we're starting to see some innovations where you're trying to change people's behavior by offering discounts or certain promotions. So Osprey have a partnership with Octopus where we're offering cheaper charging between the hours of 7 and 11. I think really, it's going to be the fleet sector where we're going to see a lot more of that going on, where they will be more price sensitive or more interested in those incentives. It's really more interesting with, I think, the home charging sector, where you're seeing the technology from providers like EV.Energy and OMI, who are controlling when you charge to manage the grid situation. So I think they're ultimately public charging. You will charge when you need to charge and where you want to charge. I think in the home charging game, there's a lot more scope here to shape the curve. Mm-hmm. The whole debate around vehicle to grid, you know, your vehicle being connected to your home, and when the price changes, your car is putting the power back into the home or back into the grid. I think there's an entire industry that's going to grow off that.
So almost like split it into two things, like have your domestic where you think there'll be this smoothness and there'll be people who try and bring flexible pricing to it so you can shape that. And then you'll have this other sort of almost more sort of, they charge based on need, and then they hit the 400 kilowatt charges, and that will have some spikes in it.
Yeah. And again, on the 400 kilowatt piece, I think where we're seeing, you know, the most demand today, most of the charges that people are looking for between, you know, 75 and you know, 150 kilowatt charges, the charges can go up to 300, 350. Mm-hmm. But predominantly with the charge rates of the vehicles, most of them are tapping out at about 150 in the peak charge rates. HGV, heavy goods vehicle charging, is coming, and there you may see a move towards 1 megawatt charging. But again, you're going to hit those charges when you need and want to charge. And then you're not really going to, if you plug into a pit stop charging location, you're not interested in, you know, flexibility and going back to the grid there. You're interested in getting your charging going. Now, the site itself might have a flexibility play, but as a car, a vehicle driver, you want to charge and go. Well, charge and go to the loo and go. For the home user, really interesting where you could go with it.
Absolutely. Okay, that's been fascinating to run through all of that. I would like to give you the opportunity to have a go at the final two questions. So one, okay, is there anything you'd like to plug?
I think I would say to anybody who has never tried an EV or tried public charging, we in the UK now, we're very lucky to have in many cases, you know, some of the world's best examples of what public charging should be like. It's reliable. It's easy to pay with a tap of a credit card. Just don't believe the myths. Try it yourself. You know, there are headlines around you need 56 apps to charge. There's no charging. There's queues. It's simply not true out there today. And if you talk to your friends or colleagues who live with an EV, many of them will say, it's brilliant, it's easy, I won't be going back. But the key point is, that is a fairly recent change in what we've built here in the UK. So go and try it. I think if you're asking me to plug, then I'm obviously going to plug the Osprey Network. And we've worked tirelessly for the last 6 years to build what we have. We've now got 1,000 public rapid charge points across the UK, from the top of Scotland to the bottom of Cornwall. Again, you can tap with a contactless bank card. Easy to use. And we have, you know, last year we were commended by Zapmap for being a recommended network for the fourth year running. And we won a number of awards for best network. So if you're going to try a network, go and try an Osprey network and give it a try. But it what we've delivered here in the UK on the ground is quite impressive in the last few years, despite all the grey clouds and the headlines. I mean, the industry became a political football last summer, which is really unhelpful. I don't think, you know, the moving of the ban that wasn't a ban by the UK government back to 2035, it didn't make any difference in terms of any laws on the cars, because the mandate for the car manufacturers is still there. The only thing it might have done is told the British public, you don't need to think about buying an EV yet. And that's really damaging in terms of the impact on consumer demand. And there's just no need for it, because the situation's never been better.
And particularly as well, like EV costs that we see, you know, you see frequent updates that EVs are getting down to cost parity with petrol, even beyond. So that future is very much here now. So it's not a case of, I think about getting an EV, I might wait 5 years. It really is, okay, you can actually go and do this now.
But this isn't great news for the leasing companies, but you can go and buy an electric Porsche now for 50 grand. And I know not everyone's got 50 grand, but that flows right the way through. The used EV prices now, there are some fantastic bargains out there. And whilst that's not great for leasing companies and car companies, for the public, there's no better time to get an EV. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I think one thing that's come through in this conversation, actually, which is fascinating for me, is that I think deep down you're a bit of a petrol head, or maybe a bit of a car head, but you deeply love EVs as someone who drives it, and it is something that you are extremely passionate about. And I think that for lots of people will be a really interesting sort of thing to listen to and just see, actually, here's someone who starts up in Volkswagen, who is now, you know, totally converted to the EV piece and couldn't be a more stronger advocate of it.
Yeah, I think we're all very conscious, though, that we have to, we live in a bubble, right? So many of us love this. We love everything we do and we believe in it so strongly. But our job now is to convince the mass market of vehicle drivers in the UK that this is the right thing to do. And unfortunately, the challenge is quite a steep one with us because of all the stuff that's going on with the media at the moment. Mm-hmm. And we've been spoilt in that the early adopter set, who love the technology, they love what they're doing. They'll sit at home and they'll watch their kilowatt hours ticking away in the app. That isn't normal. That's not the British public. Mm. So how do we now take these quite complicated messages about kilowatt hours and charge rates and CCS and, you know, charge networks? How do we just convince people like my mum to think this is the right thing to do? This is easy, there's charging everywhere, and actually this is a better experience to drive an EV than it was a petrol and diesel car. Yeah. That's the challenge. And I think what I'm excited about now is that we're seeing the charging industry, government, the car industry starting to work together to solve those problems. So look, that's the bit where we've got to maintain a balanced outlook and professionalism, because we the danger here is we get seen as tree huggers. And this is a mega industry, and we've now got to make the next leap to get to that mass adoption stage.
Agreed. Okay, and final question. What is your contrarian view? What's something that you believe that 90% of the market out there don't believe?
So the controversial viewpoint, it's probably going to be about the charging power point. I mean, there will always be a race to have the most powerful charger, the biggest charger. I see these amazing headlines of, you know, here's Europe's most powerful charger has been launched. no one's going to use it. You know, we have to play the game with the advertisers. We have to say, yes, we can charge your Porsche Taycan. But we see the data, and the data is that most vehicles charge at around, I think the average for the vehicles sold last year is around just under 100 kilowatts. So again, on your list of things you need to find a way to educate the public on, it's how on earth do we convince people that you're great, your new £100,000 Audi could charge for maybe a minute or two at 300 kilowatts, but you only need a 100 kilowatt charger. And we're, as you can tell, quite passionate about this. What I'd love to see is when you hire a car abroad in the old days and you'd open the fuel cap and it would tell you if it's petrol or diesel, and you knew, I just wish we could open the charging port in a vehicle and it would say to you, you know, max charge rate, 300 kilowatts. Well done you.
Yeah.
Your average charge rate you should expect is 90, because your mindset changes overnight. And you think, oh, wow, actually, so what you mean is there are 40,000 charge points out there which are relevant for my vehicle. So I know that there'll be people listening and watching who don't agree with this. And they say, no, this is all about the power. Let's get these 400 kilowatt chargers. It's not the real world, and it won't be. You know, for heavy goods vehicles, for Formula E, awesome. Let's have the technology race. But for 90% of the UK car driving public, not relevant.
Perfect. Ian, thank you very much for coming on. You've been a fantastic guest. You are hugely knowledgeable about the space, and I think that has really helped me understand what's going on in the EV space, but also I think our listeners as well. So great. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.